Airline Pilot Guy, episode number 15. Welcome back to the Airline Pilot Guy. I'm Captain Jeff, your host, and I find myself once again in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., at the beautiful Renaissance on M Street, and starting yet another week of flying the friendly skies. And so I'm going to talk about a lot of things, a lot of news recently that I think you'll enjoy me talking about. So let's get started. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the flight. Okay, did you see and hear or both about that Polish airline, LOT 767-300, that landed gear up on purpose? Well, sort of, in Warsaw, Poland. Yeah, let me play a little bit of the video. There are a couple of YouTube videos out there. I'll try to put one or two of those in the show notes so you can look at them as well. I'm sure you've already seen these, but let me just get this one playing here. This is one of the ones from the kind of a side view of the airplane landing without its gear on the Warsaw Chopin Airport. And right about here, it's touching down and sliding along the runway. And it comes to a stop, and they initiate the evacuation procedure. And remarkably, I don't think anybody was hurt seriously. Maybe some minor injuries due to the evacuation, but looks like everybody was safe and sound after that event. Here's another one. This was a camera phone video taken inside of the airplane.
I would like to remind you that you have to have a seatbelt fastened.
Okay, a warning about the seatbelts. Make sure your seatbelts are fastened. In this video, everybody's kind of in their brace positions. The person taking the video here, unfortunately, he wasn't pointing it out the window so we could kind of see what was happening. He was basically pointing at the seat back in front of him. And so we have to kind of listen for clues as to what's happening. A lot of fumbling with his phone. And remarkably, even when you listen to this pretty loud, the volume loud, I hear a little bit of scraping and vibration here, but, you know, not as much as you'd expect for a 767 landing without its landing. You hear some applause in the background. So they make it safely down. This whole event started in the United States at Newark International Airport, Newark Liberty International. And let me read a little bit from the Aviation Herald. A LOT, Polish Airlines Boeing 767-300, performing flight LO-16 from Newark to Warsaw, Poland, with 220 passengers and 11 crew, was on approach to Warsaw's runway 33. When the crew aborted the approach at 3,000 feet, reporting an unsafe gear indication for all three gear struts at about 1210 Zulu, 1310 local in Warsaw, entered a holding pattern to troubleshoot the problem for about 80 minutes. Visual verification by fighter aircraft, F-16, based on what I saw in the video, showed none of the gear struts were down. Attempts to lower the gear alternatively failed. The aircraft subsequently performed a textbook gear-up landing on runway 33 at 1440 local. The aircraft was evacuated after standstill. No injuries occurred. Let's see. And on Wednesday, the cranes and this happened on the 1st, almost a week ago, Tuesday of last week. The airport was kept sterile for the arrival of the emergency aircraft. Roads around the airport closed to accommodate emergency services. And they basically lifted the airplane after after they made sure that everything was, all the fires and stuff like that were out, or there was no indication of that. They brought cranes and air cushions to lift the aircraft off the runway. With the engines remaining attached to the wings, the gear could subsequently be released, and the aircraft was towed to a hangar for further assessment of the damage, which, after a first check, is said to be surprisingly small. Okay, so why were they so prepared? Well, yeah, because they had many, many, many hours to know that there was going to possibly be a problem with this airplane. You didn't get me wrong here. The airplane took off in Newark, New Jersey, and landed in Poland. And about 30 minutes after departure from Newark, the crew reported the failure of the center hydraulic system. It is unclear why the gear could not be lowered. This is being investigated. Right away, we know that this flight leaves. It's still within the U.S. airspace. I mean, they haven't even received oceanic clearance, as far as I know, after 30 minutes from takeoff. So they have an indication that they've lost their center hydraulic system. And from what I know, I haven't flown the 767 myself, but I've read that that is the hydraulic system that powers the landing gear. Well, you know, it shouldn't be a problem because all aircraft are certified to have some way of alternatively lowering the landing gear. Now, the airplane that I fly basically is just a gravity system where you basically release some of the uplocks mechanically in the case of my airplane. And once those uplocks are released, just the weight of the gear and gravity brings them down, and the over-center locks go into place, and you should have safe gear indication, unless you have some kind of other problem going on. I've been told, again, I have not flown the 767, so I'm not sure about this, but I've heard that the uplocks that hold the gear and the gear doors in place on that particular airplane are electronically powered. So if you lose hydraulics and you lose electricity, you're not going to be able to get the gear down, apparently. Now, that seems kind of strange to me. I would think that there would be some kind of a mechanical backup for those uplocks. I don't know. For those of you out there listening who are pilots or are certified on the 76, why don't you send me some feedback and let me know what's the deal there. So it sounds like it was a little bit more than just a hydraulic system malfunction that caused this incident. But anyway, some of you may be wondering, you pilots out there, I was wondering this myself. Okay, I have an airplane with 220 passengers, and I'm going to fly all the way across the North Atlantic, all the way to Poland. I don't know how long that flight is, but, you know, 7-8 hour flight, maybe longer. In the middle of the night, over the Atlantic Ocean, with a known, you know, problem, a major problem. You know, losing one of your hydraulic systems is an emergency situation. So, why did the captain and first officer, namely the captain, continue the flight? I don't know. Apparently, they must have had some kind of discussion with their company, and they decided that it would be best to deal with the problem after they were over in their homeland, the skies of over Poland, to work everything out. Now, again, I don't know if they knew that they were going to have a problem lowering the gear. You know, we know when we lose certain hydraulic systems, okay, I know what systems are affected. And so in the back of your mind, you're thinking, you know, what could possibly be working, what may not be working, etc. But I just find it strange that that they didn't land as soon as conditions permit at a suitable airport. And I know that if that had happened with a U.S. airline, and most of the guys I know would say, hey, we have a problem. We're going to take care of it. We're going to troubleshoot it. We're going to land here instead of taking an airplane all the way across the Atlantic. So a little strange. Now, I don't know what the ramifications are for the pilot, Captain Tadeusz Rona. By the way, excellent job. I mean, that landing was just picture perfect, beautiful. Set it down on both engines, and it went straight as an arrow right down the runway until the last few feet where it kind of veered off a little bit to the right. So, you know, my hat is off to the piloting skills. Beautiful landing, probably the best landing of his life. But again, I'm I'm questioning the judgment of why take an airplane that with a known malfunction all the way across the pond. Anyway, so that's that about the 767. Very, very interesting. And it looks like maybe they'll be able to use that airplane again. I don't know. You know, is that the definition of a good landing? You can walk away from it. Okay, we check that box. And we may be able to use the airplane again. Yeah, sounds like a good landing to me. I don't know. We'll have to see what kind of damage occurred. About just a few days before this, that was on Tuesday, the previous weekend on Saturday of the Halloween weekend, I don't know if that's the official name for that weekend, but on the 29th, the Northeast kind of received an unexpected visit from winter weather, snow. And you probably heard about some of the problems with some of the airlines dealing with Mother Nature. Okay, now enter JetBlue. Yeah, you may have heard of JetBlue in the past. They've had several incidents over the past several years of, keeping people on airplanes for long, long, long periods of time. In fact, most of the incidents, now correct me if I'm wrong, but from my memory, most of the incidents, the ones that you heard about in the news before we had this 3-hour tarmac rule, involved JetBlue. At least, the ones that were highlighted in the media. Yes, there were some other airlines, but a disproportionate number were JetBlue incidents. And now, we've had that 3-hour tarmac rule in effect, I don't know, not quite 2 years, I believe. And it's really cut down on the number of incidents of keeping people on airplanes much, much longer than they should be. However, JetBlue ran into trouble again on the 29th of October when this snowfall hit the New England states. And so JetBlue 504 was flying from Fort Lauderdale to Kennedy, their home base. And that's about a 3-hour flight. And as they approached, they realized that because of volume and the weather and everything else, they weren't going to be able to land at Kennedy. So they decided to divert to Bradley International Airport, which is just north of Hartford, Connecticut, and just south of Springfield, Massachusetts, in the lovely town of Windsor Locks. And it is lovely. Beautiful country up there. And they also got hit by the snow as well, but it wasn't quite as congested as the New York airports. So they land after 3 hours plus of flying, and they didn't have a gate. Now, I'm not sure exactly what transpired from the time they actually landed at Bradley International, and when we start hearing some of this recording of the incident, they are now on the ground in at the Bradley International Airport, and they have been now for coming up on about 7.5 hours. Okay, so let's add this together. About 3 hours of flying, and then another 7+ hours on the ground on the tarmac. So these people have been in this airplane more than 10 hours, maybe more than 11 hours by this point. And so let's take a listen to this audio provided by liveatc.net.
504, November 504, roger. If you try to come on with a jetway now and flash a trooper's uniform on this plane, it's not going to be good. It's not going to be pretty. They've calmed down a little bit. I told them we're waiting for the gate. We're just waiting for a tug and a tow bar, and it's only a matter of seconds. So I tell you, do not bring anybody on board this plane. You're not going to open the door, so don't even put the air stairs up there.
Okay, roger that.
Be worse, bud. I appreciate your efforts, but it'll be worse if you try to put a trooper on here right now.
Hey, what's going on, guys? They're having issues with that tug over on the gate, so just bear with us and we'll get you over there, I promise.
All right, thanks. Tell those guys to move that jetway, the air stairs away from the plane.
Okay. So here we are at the 7.5 hour point after having diverted to Bradley International. Again, I don't know what the details are. I don't know how many times they tried to coordinate getting a gate at Bradley, or if they decided to stay on the ramp and wait for the weather to improve in New York and get refueled and refiled and everything else. And perhaps they didn't have any intention to get the passengers off the airplane. I don't know. But I do know that at this point, he is telling them, no, don't put the troopers on. That's just going to make a bad situation worse. Okay, shortly after that little transmission, let's listen to this next one.
JetBlue 504.
Blue 504, Bradley Ground, go ahead.
I got a problem here on the airplane. I'm going to need to have the cops on board. There's a cop car sitting in front of me right here right now. I need some air stairs brought over here and a cops brought on board the airplane.
JetBlue 504, roger. State 6, Ground.
I copy that, understand. We're getting air stairs now.
State 6, roger. And State 6, is there a trooper outside the aircraft on the ramp? JetBlue 504, do you have a minute? Do you need anything else from us?
504, we just would like to get the air stairs. We see two buses out here that we can start deplaning some people, and we're waiting on the sheriff, so hold on.
Roger.
Okay. That last voice is the, I'm assuming, is the first officer, the co-pilot. So now something is transpiring in the back. These people, you know, they've been without food and water. You know, they're hungry, they're tired, maybe cold. I don't know if they have been running the APU or not. I'd certainly hope so. And apparently things are just getting to the breaking point in the back. And they say, oh, never mind. Yes, we want the troopers on board because things are kind of falling apart very quickly. Okay, people are at their wit's end in the back of that airplane. Okay, let's continue. Oh, by the way, if you're wondering who the controlling authority is that they're talking to, that's ground control. They're up in the control tower with the tower controller. The tower controller controls the point of takeoff and initial departure, and also brings in people after they're handed off by approach control. They talk to the tower controller. He's the one that gives he or she gives clearance to land. And when they are exiting the runway, he tells them to contact ground control. And then, so this is the ground controller we're talking to right now, or he is talking to.
Yeah, Grant, if you can, if you can somehow communicate to anyone outside there, tell them they got the wrong airplane. We're with a little 190 next to the Airbus there.
Okay, this is another JetBlue parked right next to the JetBlue 504, which is an Airbus 320. The RJ Regional Jet 190 is it's not a small airplane, but it's not as large as a 320. And I'm not sure how many passengers the 190 holds. I think right around 100, 95, something like that. And apparently, the state of Connecticut, the airport authority, whoever is bringing up the air stairs, they're going to the wrong airplane. Ooh, not good. Things are getting worse.
Well, they need to get on the Airbus. We're trying to come outside, and I'm just looking out to it. Good old deer in headlights. All right, JetBlue 1080, you're parked next to JetBlue 504, and they're trying to go to you instead of the Airbus?
That's correct. We're the 190, and the Airbus needs us more than we do.
All right, State 6 at ground frequency, just have the air stairs go over to the Airbus A320, not the Embraer 190. They're both parked over by Alpha 22.
Copy that. They're pulling the stairs up as we speak.
So apparently, they brought the air stairs up to the 190. People there, you know, knocking on the door, and he said they look like they're a deer staring at headlights. So they finally get them to go over to the correct airplane.
JetBlue 504.
JetBlue 504, go ahead.
Look, you know, we can't seem to get any help from our own company. I apologize for this, but is there any way you can get a tug and a tow bar out here to us and get us towed somewhere to a gate or something? I don't care. Take us anywhere.
JetBlue 504, roger. I will talk to state operations, see what they can do.
Were you able to resolve the situation in the back, or is that still ongoing?
Yes, we've resolved it for now. We've got the show of authorities on board, but I have a paraplegic on board that needs to come off. I have a diabetic on here that's got an issue. It's a list of things. I just got to get some help.
Roger, do you need any paramedics or anything like that?
Well, we've got the fire truck over here, and I guess they have some medical background here. I'm not sure who all the players are back there in the back yet, but it looks like they've got it covered. My priority right now is a tug and a tow bar. If you just give me a welding shop, I'll be willing to make one myself.
JetBlue 504, Roger. I'll pass the message along.
Thank you, sir.
Stage 6, ground.
Ground and stage 3. We copy about that.
Stage 3, Roger. Will you be able to, I know you're busy down there, if you have any resources for the JetBlue 504?
We are working the best we can, yes. Thank you.
Okay, a lot going on. You know, just add something here. It's not just these two JetBlue airplanes. I think there are about 7 JetBlue airplanes that diverted up to Bradley. I don't know how many of them actually are using the JetBlue gates and how many are stuck off the gate. But there are other airlines, including Acme. We had some airplanes up at Bradley, but I believe we didn't have any problems finding gates for our diverted airplanes. Not sure about that, but I didn't hear anything adverse regarding Acme or any other airline for that matter. So you can hear the exasperation in the captain's voice. He's saying, give me a welding shop. I'll make the darn tow bar. Now, again, has there been any attempt made to do this an hour ago, 2 hours ago, 5 hours ago, 6 hours ago? I don't know. You know, to be honest and to be fair, perhaps there have been attempts. Sounds like the captain is getting a little frustrated with his company. Not helping at all. And now he's appealing to the state of Connecticut, the airport authority.
On the ground here at Bradley, or is that the 7.5 hours?
No, that doesn't include that. Hang on just a second.
And we're just having a few questions from Washington.
Yeah, no problem. Let's see. We left Lauderdale at 1407C. And I'm off the gate at 1407. We were off. That's irrelevant to you. So we're out of Lauderdale at 1407Z, and we got on the ground at 1724Z, and we've been here now for 7.5 hours after the on the ground 1724. So what is it? 0054 now. So right at 7.5 hours plus the 3 hours of flight time or whatever that was.
JetBlue 504, Roger.
Okay, so obviously the people in the control tower are know that something is going on here. They've been on the ground for quite some time. They're trying to kind of take some notes here. Obviously, Washington, FAA in Washington, is asking some questions about what's going on with this tarmac situation, and they're trying to gather some data. And then finally, we'll end with this last clip.
Now, JetBlue 504.
JetBlue 504, ground, go ahead.
Hey, listen, man, I just want to put my 2 cents worth in for whatever it's worth. Thank you very much. It's Captain Thompson over here at, on 504. Just thank you very much for helping us out, because I think we got more help from you guys than our own people.
JetBlue 504, you're welcome. It's our pleasure. Have a minute. Is there anything else you need from us at this time?
But sir, man, I think you've gone above and beyond for us. We certainly appreciate it. I guess they're going to get these people offloaded, take them over to gate 20 or something like that. We got a tug and tow bar sitting right here in front of us. We're going to get hooked up. I don't know what gate we're going to. Maybe a little assistance on the tug and tow to tell us what gate we're going to. But other than that, then they're going to move over to the 1088, who's sitting right next door to us, and offload them. Those folks with the buses do the same thing, I guess.
Yeah, they offloaded all the passengers onto buses.
They did.
Okay, Roger. Yeah, we were just, like I said, getting some questions from Washington, so I wanted to make sure that everything was sorted out on your end.
Yeah, that's what I figured. Yeah, they're still offloading. They got those itty-bitty, short buses kind of thing. So they're still offloading people here, and we're still going at it, man. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
I'm a little confused here. I'm thinking to myself, if they're going to get the tug and the tow bar to tow the airplane to a gate, but they're offloading the people now. Once the airplane's offloaded, I say, take that tug and tow bar, put it on the airplane that still has passengers, and forget about the stupid buses. Bring them to the terminal. Put a jetway on this thing. Get these people into the terminal so they can eat, so they can walk around, so they can use the bathroom. I don't know. I'm getting exasperated just thinking about this whole situation. How is it that guys let this happen? Again, if you're listening to my podcast, Captain Thompson, call me, send me an email. Let me know what's going on. I'm sure there's more to the story. I mean, there just has to be. Obviously, because this was in the media and, you know, a little bit of public outcry, again, by the behavior of JetBlue, here is something that was put out by the CEO of JetBlue.
Hi, my name is Rob Marister, and I'm Chief Operating Officer of JetBlue, and I'm coming to you from our System Operations Control Center here in Forest Hills, New York. As many of you now know, JetBlue had 6 flights divert to Hartford, Connecticut over the weekend due to various runway congestion and other operational issues at Newark and JFK airports. And we did not deplane those aircraft in our target time allotted. At no point in this weekend was safety ever compromised in any of our decision making, whether it was our customers or our crew members. And in fact, safety was their number one concern. But let's face it, at JetBlue, you count on us for a lot more, and we promise a lot more. And we know we let some of you down over the course of this weekend, and for that, we are truly sorry. Going forward, we plan to fully participate with the Department of Transportation in cooperating with their investigation into the events over the weekend. And we're also going to conduct an internal evaluation so that we can learn from this event. Because at the end of the day, you deserve better, and we expect better from our crew members and our operation. We can only earn your loyalty and trust one flight at a time, and we ask you to give us a second chance. Thank you.
Okay, kind of a mea culpa by the CEO of JetBlue, you know, obviously knowing that, hey, oops, you know, oops, we did it again. Sorry about that. We'll try better next time. Don't leave us for other airlines. And you know what? Honestly, nobody's going to. Nobody really cares about what. Now, maybe those of you listening to this podcast, you guys are smart. You probably are not the normal passenger, but honestly, people really don't care who they're flying with. They just go on the internet and find the cheapest fare, and that's the airline they use. Now, of course, there's some issues regarding, you know, loyalty points and that kind of thing that come into play. But, you know, people are going to keep flying JetBlue. They're probably going to get a slap on the wrist from the government. Hey, you know what? You know that 3-hour tarmac rule has a penalty, $27,500 per passenger involved in the incident. Do you know how many airlines have been fined so far since this rule has gone into effect? Again, I believe about a year and a half ago, not quite 2 years ago. You know how many? Zero. Not one airline has been fined. Why? Because there's a kind of a clause, a get out of jail free card in there. If there's some kind of an extenuating circumstance, like weather, that caused the extended delay, well, then maybe the airline doesn't get fined. Now, am I interested in seeing airlines get fined to improve their behavior? Yeah, I am. I think the Department of Transportation or whoever it is that has to make the decision that somebody gets fined, they need to do it, and they need to do it more often so that this doesn't happen. You know, I think now people are going, you know what? I don't think that the government's really, really serious about this whole $27,500 fine per passenger. So they're going to push it. And they're going to have do some, you know, damage control from situations like this. But I'm afraid they're going to continue to operate like this, sadly. Okay, so you out there, you're a captain, act like a captain. Do the right thing. Don't keep these people on the airplane longer than they need to be. Okay, let's see here. I got this from one of my listeners, John Clem. Thank you, John. He sent me a link to this article, aboard the Boeing 787 Dreamliner. It's finally flying. It was delivered, the first one delivered to All Nippon Airways, a Japanese company. And the first flight was from Tokyo to Hong Kong. And it says on Wednesday, but that was a couple weeks ago, I believe. And it says the ultra-modern 787 is being hailed in the aviation industry for its technological innovations, including the carbon fiber construction that makes it the first jetliner not made of traditional aluminum and steel. So it's a big plastic airplane, just like our toys. No, I don't have any toys anymore, but, you know, you remember those, right? Apparently, this airplane's pretty cool. It has very large windows, much larger than a normal airliner window, so that's great for the passengers. No window shades. It's some kind of a system that you push buttons and you darken and lighten the windows. Let's see. Also, some pretty cool stuff going on in the control surfaces of the airplane. All these computers are constantly sensing forces like G-forces and that kind of thing. So when you get into turbulence, there are some things working to kind of help dampen the effect of turbulence. So it's a pretty sophisticated airplane. I know Boeing has had some trouble with the timeline getting this thing, you know, out there and delivered to airlines, but hey, finally, it's there. And people are impressed. Now, this is a very short flight, so hard to say, you know, what type of experience people are going to have on the long haul. But they promise it's going to be a pleasant experience for everybody on these long haul flights. So we shall see. Remember I reported not too long ago, several episodes ago, about the Russian airplane, the Yak-42, that took off and had the entire elite hockey team, called the Lokomotivs, I believe, a Russian hockey team, was on board, and I think it was a charter flight, and they crashed. And turns out that there's a report out. I don't know if it's a final report or just an intermediate report, basically saying that pilot error, again, was the cause of the accident. Says that one of the pilots accidentally pressed the brakes on the landing gear so that the aircraft was moving too slowly when it tried to take off. Apparently, both pilots were had some experience in the Yak-40 aircraft, and this was the Yak-42 was kind of new to them, and they really hadn't had a chance to go in the simulator to get any simulator time with this thing. And apparently the Yak-40's pedals are laid out a little bit differently, and the braking system is a little bit different, and a little bit of confusion on the takeoff roll. I mean, we have, I shouldn't laugh because, you know, many people died in this crash, but the flight engineer was, you know, grabbing throttles and pulling them back to idle when they were supposedly continuing the takeoff, and we have somebody on the brakes, and obviously they're not accelerating as rapidly as possible, and then one of them's yelling, "What are you doing? You know, we're going," and then they're putting takeoff power back on, and it was just too late after that to try to abort the takeoff and save the aircraft, and they crashed. So quite a mess. So I just wanted to update you on that investigation. Very sad. Let's see. Oh, if we've talked about iPads in the airplane, electronic devices, that kind of thing. A lot of airplanes, a lot of pilots now are using iPads, and a lot of airline pilots actually are using iPads in the cockpit for various things, whether it be, you know, to view charts or manuals or whatever. And executive jet management was one of the first ones to employ the use of the iPad, and I think it's a good idea, by the way, my personal opinion. However, the latest version of the iOS software, iOS 5, includes a feature, if you want to call it that. It's called a cleanup feature that will delete saved data when system memory becomes low. So if an operator has 1 gigabyte of free space and downloads a 3 gig file, then the system will delete 2 gigabytes of data from the other apps to make room. Now, it's here's a little blurb here that I think we need to emphasize. According to the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, the data is deleted with little warning and only a small cleaning message appearing. Okay, well, to be fair, there is a warning that you're about to have data deleted. Are you sure you want to download this new stuff? Because I'm going to delete stuff to make room for it. So, yeah, I know. It's not completely foolproof, but come on. It does warn you before it erases data that you might need. Apparently, companies that make software for the iPad are coming up with ways to alleviate this situation. So, just a warning, if you're out there with one of the iPads and you're using Jeppesen Mobile Flight Deck or Mobile TC or some other application like ForeFlight, make sure you have lots of room on your flash drive there before you download anything else, because you might be up there flying and not have the approach plate that you need. So just thought I'd let you know. Apparently, we're still having trouble with lasers. The FAA and ALPA have both launched websites dealing with the threat of lasers. You know, those little laser light pens that people are getting stronger and stronger over time. And people are thinking, hey, it'd be really cool to shine one of these things up in the air at this jet cockpit, not realizing that we are temporarily blinded by these darn things and could really, really seriously affect the safety of our airline operation, or any kind of operation. Doesn't necessarily have to be airline operation. Let's see. Here's an episode on October 30th, 1995. So it's been some time ago since this incident, but a first officer on a Southwest Airlines flight sustained a debilitating eye injury after being irradiated by a laser beam on departure from McCarran International Airport, Las Vegas. It was climbing through about 7,000 feet MSL on a standard instrument departure route. He saw the pilot in command, first officer. Pilot in command, first officer? I guess they mean the pilot flying, the first officer. Reported the laser beam was swept through the cockpit, resulting in temporary blindness and pain in his right eye. In addition to after-image effects that impaired the vision in his left eye, the pilot could not focus or interpret any instrument indications and was disoriented. Hey, you know, it's a good idea that we have, or a good thing that we have more than one person in these cockpits, right? Now, tell that to the Ryanair CEO who wants to get rid of two pilots in the cockpit. Too many. Twice as many as you need. All you need is one up there, right? Yeah, until we're blinded by a laser, or we eat the fish, you know, have you seen the movie Airplane? Or we have a heart attack or something. So I think it's still a good idea to have at least two of us up in the cockpit. Now, I don't know what your political viewpoint is, and it doesn't matter, and doesn't matter what mine is either, but I thought that this was sort of funny. I'm not sure exactly what this means. I'll just read the headline, and then you can take from it what you'd like. The headline is, a 50-pound slab of blue ice falls off Air Force One, narrowly missing Occupy Las Vegas protesters. This happened about a week ago. You know, we've been seeing all these Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Atlanta, Occupy blah, blah, blah. These groups out there who are protesting the inequity of our income in this country. And yeah, there are some inequities, that's for sure. But they're out there demonstrating, protesting, which is our right as a citizen of our country. But they were out there protesting, actually camping on Clark County land located under the final approach to runway 19 at McCarran International Airport. And the Air Force One, the 747, with our president on board, dropped a 50-pound slab of blue ice. Now, what you're probably asking to yourself, what is blue ice? Well, don't eat the blue ice. Trust me, you don't want to do that. Blue ice, you know that blue liquid that's in the lavatories of airplanes with all the chemicals make it that blue color and kind of take care of the stuff that goes into a toilet to kind of neutralize it a little bit. Well, that when that stuff leaks from, you know, like valves and stuff like that that aren't supposed to leak, but occasionally they do. As soon as they hit the really, really sub-freezing temperatures up at altitude, it immediately turns into ice. And then more fluid leaks and makes a bigger and bigger ball of ice. And, yeah, it can be very dangerous, especially if it detaches from the airplane and falls on your head. So, close call there from the protesters, the Occupy Las Vegas protesters. almost got hit by a big ball of frozen urine.
Ugh.
Yuck. I apologize for the, you probably are hearing the fan from my little MacBook. I pulled up that webpage about the 50-pound slab of blue ice, and apparently it has some flash on it. Flash is evil. And that makes the little CPU in my MacBook just go nuts. So, anyway, sorry about that. Okay, let's continue with some news. Regulators want tails checked on Boeing 757s. They're not talking about passengers here. They're talking about the actual tail of the airplane. They want the airlines to check for hazardous corrosion on movable tail parts on hundreds of Boeing 757 jets that could result in pilots losing control of aircraft. You may remember, I don't know how long ago it's been now, maybe 15 years or so, Alaska Air MD-80 had some trouble with the jack screw that moves the horizontal stabilizer into position on the back tail. Well, not the back tail. There's only one tail on the tail of the aircraft. And instead of landing as soon as they could, they decided they would go out and troubleshoot the situation to see if they could continue the flight. Unfortunately, during the troubleshooting, the jack screw failed and they lost complete control of that horizontal stabilizer. And you can't fly an airplane without a horizontal stabilizer. Sorry. They crashed, unfortunately. And they're saying that this system that they're seeing some corrosion on kind of is the same kind of deal, except this time it's not an MD-80 series airplane. It's the Boeing 757. So I'm sure by now investigations have already happened and they have fixed the offensive corroded parts. Now, here's some advice to you. You may have heard of this. A man from Atlanta, Buckhead, leaving Las Vegas, here we go, Las Vegas in the news again, decides for some reason that he doesn't want to continue on the flight from Las Vegas to Atlanta. So what does he do? Well, he tries to open up the emergency exit, the overwing exit on the airplane. Not a good idea. Now, let's think this through here. Can you actually open up an overwing exit or a door for that matter on an airplane that's pressurized? No. Now, you know, you've been watching movies and television series and they do it all the time, right? Well, no, you can't. When an airplane is pressurized and that occurs, you know, right about the right before takeoff or during the takeoff roll or shortly after we take off, depending on the airplane and the system, it occurs very, very rapidly in the first part of the flight. And once the airplane is pressurized, all that pressure is going to keep any of those doors from opening, no matter how strong you are, even if you're Hercules. You can't do it. But, of course, everybody's sitting around this guy, 60-year-old Richard Joel Garber. They don't know that, apparently, and they freak out. This guy is trying to open up a hole in the airplane. That is not good, they know. And they restrain the passenger and returned to Las Vegas McCarran International Airport. And he was greeted by the police greeting committee back at the gate. Whereabouts of Mr. Garber? Unknown. No, I don't know what the disposition of that case is, but I'm sure that he is in a little bit of trouble. Speaking of parts being investigated and stuff like this, this actually has been, well, it's about a month ago when I clipped this article, and I just haven't had a chance to talk about it, but the 767, yeah, it's in the news again, on some airlines, let's see, United, Delta, American Airlines, and other U.S. carriers need to check their 767s twice as often after one operator found significant crack sizes had developed sooner than expected in the wings. Yikes. Wing skin cracks are occurring as large as about a half an inch, 1.3 centimeters, near fastener holes. So Boeing thought that you could go about 18,900 flight cycles and about 89,500 total flight hours before you had to do the inspection on these areas. But nope, they're going to have to do it about in half that time and just kind of monitor the progress of these cracks. So they need to watch it closely. Let's see here. I have some feedback. Why don't we jump to that?
Message for you, son.
Our first bit of feedback is from Laura Vlasic from San Diego. Hi, Captain Jeff. I'm a fan of a variety of your podcasts and have been following this one since it was Catholic Pilot. Last month, you asked people to tell you about their experiences on 9/11/2001. I want to share with you my memory of 9/25/1978. It was the beginning of my junior year at the Academy of Our Lady Peace in the North Park neighborhood of San Diego. Our girls' school had an arrangement with the boys' school, St. Augustine's, whereby upperclassmen could take classes on either campus for the first two periods of the day. That meant that around 9 a.m. and 10 a.m. every day, lots of teens were driving the 3 miles between schools. On that sunny Monday morning about 9 o'clock, my friends and I had gotten out of our first class and were waiting for some of the girls to get back from Saints. We heard a loud boom and saw the fireball just a couple miles away. We had no idea what we had witnessed for a few minutes until some of the commuting students drove up to the school in fear, panic, and hysteria. The path between our schools was basically the debris path for the disintegrating 727. As they drove or sat at stoplights, these poor teenagers saw twisted burning metal and, tragically, bodies falling from the sky. Some of this even landed on their cars. Oh, that's terrible. Needless to say, both schools went into lockdown while everyone was trying to understand what was going on. Once we heard it was a PSA jet, one of my friends was distraught because her parents were returning to town that day on PSA. Thankfully, they were on another flight. I don't remember how many days it was until things got back to normal, but it was a defining moment for lots of us in San Diego. While things were unpleasant at my school, my heart has always gone out to the students and staff at St. Augustine High. They were much closer to the crash site and offered their gym as a temporary morgue. At the time, it was the deadliest air crash in the history of the United States. It was an accident, not an act of terror, but happening in the safe bubble of our high school neighborhood and impacting my friends. This event left its mark on me. Well, thank you, Laura. That has got to be devastating. That was a kind of a defining moment in aviation accident history. That coupled with the crash about 8 years later over Cerritos, California, not far from where I grew up in Los Alamitos, an Aeromexico DC-9 was on approach to Los Angeles International and hit a general aviation aircraft also. And that crashed and killed everybody on board of that too. And those two events and some others, but especially that last one, the Aeromexico, finally moved our government to go forward with a system that we call the TCAS system, which stands for the Traffic Collision Avoidance System. And we've been using that for, I don't know, 15, 20 years now. And anytime you get in an airplane where the TCAS system is not working, you feel like you're naked. Having that information, you know, we have a screen that's put on, it's put or superimposed or imposed upon our radar display that shows other aircraft. It uses the transponder. The transponder is the device in the airplane that sends information to air traffic control radar and gives them information about our call sign, what type of airplane we are, what our speed is, what our altitude is. It just gives them a nice defined target. And that transponder can talk to other transponders if they're properly equipped with a mode S transponder. And the transponder in my airplane can see transponders in other airplanes around me and know, you know, where they are in relation to my airplane. It gives a general bearing, direction from where we are to where they are, although it's not supposed to be that accurate. But the altitude information is accurate. And it uses altitude information to analyze whether or not you have good separation and your rate of climb, descent, whatever, is not going to be a potential collision. If it is, it gives you a warning to begin with. And then it says something like traffic. And then if it looks like it's going to be definitely a potential collision, then it gives a resolution advisory. We call it an RA. And that's when you get some information or some guidance directing you to either maintain your altitude or to maintain your present rate of climb or descent. And it also gives the same kind of warning to the other Mode S transponder equipped airplane. And then tragedy is averted if everybody is following the resolution advisory. And there have been a couple different cases now where an airplane has, a flight crew has disregarded the resolution advisory and instead have followed directions by air traffic control, and they have resulted in collisions as well. So it's not, again, like everything in aviation, it's not completely 100% foolproof, but I tell you what, it has made a big difference. I'm convinced, and in the number of midair collisions in flying in the last 10, 15, 20 years. And as I said, it sure is nice as a pilot to see all the other airplanes around me or within our, you know, specified range, and to have an idea of, you know, where to look out the window to see if you can sight them. Because that's very important. If we can actually see the airplane, then we can disregard any instruction it may be getting us, giving us, as long as we are, you know, convinced that we are going to take the appropriate action to avoid a collision. But, you know, when you're in the soup, can't see a thing, and this thing is warning you of traffic around you and giving you a resolution advisory, it's nice. So that that PSA accident that Lura told us about in her feedback and the Cerritos disaster were basically big impetuses. Impeti? I'm not sure what the plural is of impetus. But they made a big push in the industry to get these TCAS systems in all airplanes. Well, at least all airliners. Okay, have some more feedback. Somebody sent me some feedback, Steve did, about the 767 belly landing in Warsaw that we've already talked about at the beginning of the podcast today. He was wondering about what I thought about it, and he said it looked as divinely directed as the miracle on the Hudson. Well, perhaps. I don't know. He said he'd wait for my response in my next podcast, so there you go. By now, you already know what I said about it at the beginning. But thanks for your feedback anyway, Steve. And let's see, William wrote in and said, "Hi, Jeff. I'm an aspiring pilot from Australia. Just wondering, what do pilots talk about on the long flights, and how do they keep amused?" William. Well, everybody knows, William, that pilots, when they're in flight, talk about girls, and when pilots are on the ground and around girls, they talk about flying. And that is a joke, but there is some truth to that, actually. you know, I don't fly the super long flights, so I don't know, but I can just guess. Well, you know, I used to. I used to fly the Lockheed L-1011 and doing the long flights to Honolulu and back. And really, you know, you talk a little bit about this and that, but there are mostly long periods of silence. You're kind of doing your own thinking, and you're having your own conversations with yourself. A lot of quiet. You know, if you're the gabby kind of person, hopefully you're with another aircrew member who is gabby as well, because if you're like me and you're with a aircrew member who won't shut up and you're looking out the window wondering when they're going to stop talking and you want to pull your hair out. No, I'm just kidding. But all kinds of stuff. You know, what do we do to keep ourselves amused? Well, not a lot to do. You know, we're busy doing calculations, in-flight calculations. We're busy talking with air traffic control and that kind of thing. And, of course, reading and watching movies. No, I'm just kidding. That was a joke, especially if the FAA is listening. All right, and let's see. Finally, let's see, how many minutes have I been going here? Oh, I've been going too long. Hey, Mike Garcia, he's sent me feedback in the past. I'm going to hold your feedback for the next show. And it's great feedback, by the way, and a great idea. on your part. So we'll do that on the next podcast. And let's see. I had another little piece of feedback I wanted to end the show with. Okay, I had a little trouble finding the feedback, but hey, I found it. Too many darn email accounts. This is from my good friend, Pat Padley. He and his brother, Nick, do a podcast together called In Between Sundays. And that's been on hiatus for a little while, but a great podcast. Hey, guys, you need to do it. Do it again. Anyway, he started by sending me a tweet that he was on an airplane going from Kansas City, where he lives, to Boston. And then he sent me this email feedback. He says, "Hi, Jeff. So my flight back to Kansas City from Boston was fine. We were delayed by about 20 minutes because the tower gave them a new flight plan. The captain said they had to program it in the computer. Two questions. How often do flight plans change and why? And also, how hard is it to program?" So first question, how often do they change? Not very often. I'd say maybe, I don't know if I gave a percentage, maybe one out of 20 flights, one out of 30 flights, something like that. You might get a different flight plan than you had originally filed or your dispatcher had filed for you. And that is usually due to either flow control, traffic issues that Washington, FAA in Washington has this big, you know, fancy computer system that kind of analyzes all the potential flights and potential congestion and that kind of thing. And they may, to alleviate some pressure on a certain arrival going into a big hub airport, they may decide that, you know what, let's take these flights. And I know they normally go this way, but let's bring them around this way to kind of alleviate some of the pressure and the traffic congestion. And when we get our pre-departure clearance, either from our little computer display inside the airplane that prints out our clearance, and we always check that to make sure it matches the one that we have on our flight plan. Or if we're at an airport that doesn't have the digital delivery system, we call up clearance delivery, a frequency, a position in the control tower that reads us the clearance. And sometimes they'll say, "Hey, you know, we have a new clearance. Are you ready to copy?" And then you write down the new flight plan clearance. And then you go and you kind of go, "I just spent all that time putting in my original flight plan and now I have to change it." And we have to, depending on the flight management computer, it could be something that just takes a few minutes to do. It may be more elaborate based, again, on the flight management computer, the FMC, and the complexity of the flight. If it's a long flight, it's going to take a little bit longer because you can't just push one or two buttons and then it magically shows up. You actually have to, you know, do a lot of button pushing to make sure that the flight plan is correct. And then you have to verify it because you don't want to go off and fly the wrong route of flight, because the FAA, they do not have a sense of humor about that kind of thing. So that's how often and why, and also how hard is it to program? Oh, I basically just answered that as well. Not that hard, really. Now, in the old days, the L-1011, I mentioned that earlier, we had a very rudimentary flight management computer, and you actually had to put in each point, which may sound easy, but each point was defined by a latitude longitude. So you had to put N, you know, 50432.5, W, blah, 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 all these numbers in for each and every point. Now, if you're along a jetway, there might be, especially if you're going across the country, there may be, I don't know, 10, 12 waypoints along that jetway that in today's modern flight management computer, you just put in the jetway designator, jet 41, jet 191, whatever, and it automatically puts in all those points for you. But back in the old days, yeah, you little whippersnappers. Back in the old days, we had to enter each of those points using the latitude longitude. So it took quite some time, but we weren't complaining because, you know, it was either that or just get radar vectors and rely on, you know, using ground-based navigational aids. And trust me, it was worth putting in the latitudes and longitudes on the L-1011. Anyway, so not that hard. Now, why did it take 20 minutes? I'd say that it didn't take all of 20 minutes to get a new flight plan and enter it. There was probably something else going on, but they didn't want to, you know, go into all the detail. It may have been that they had an additional delay for, you know, flow control in their route of flight, but they just thought it wasn't worth explaining all that, and they just told you the generic, we have a new flight plan. Let's see. Lastly, while we were delayed, I kept talking to my colleagues about this clip from Brian Reagan. You should play it on your show. So he sent me this this clip, and I'll end the show by playing it. And this is by the comedian Brian Reagan, and it's called Takeoff Delay.
So my flight coming here was delayed by a half hour. Backed away from the gate on time. Just sat there for a half hour. Nothing you can do. You ever want to knock on the door up there? Why don't we all head where we're going? That's what we're all talking about back here. But you don't do that. You just sit there like a goober. After a half hour, the captain finally gets on.
Oh, folks. Let me tell you what's going on up here.
I hope it's good. Has that ever followed anything even remotely good?
Let me tell you what's going on up here. We found a big bag of money on board. And the tower has instructed us to divvy it amongst all you passengers. We apologize for the delay. The problem is each individual stack is getting so high they keep toppling over. And the rubber bands we've been using keep snapping on the sides of these bundles. Apologies from the flood.
It's never that. It's always,
somebody put our engine in upside down. And there's only one tool in our galaxy that can fix this. And it's in Madagascar. The tower has instructed us to go to a holding area and remain there until everyone on board dies a natural death.
So you go there and die.
Thanks a lot, Pat, for sending in the feedback, and that especially for that link to Brian Reagan. He has some other good stuff, too. He has a little blurb about baggage, which I'll play in a future episode. So I hope you enjoyed that. Again, that was Brian Reagan, a comedian. I've never heard of him, actually, but funny guy. And you, too, can send feedback. How, you ask? feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. Or you can call my voice feedback number, which is 304-99-PILOT. 304-997-4568. That information you can find on the Airline Pilot Guy website or the CatholicPilot.com website, or probably right there on your podcast if you have downloaded it. Thank you for doing that, by the way. Subscribe, head over to iTunes and subscribe to the podcast. You know, leave a review and let everybody else know about this thing if you think it's worth it. I'm on Facebook, Captain Jeff. You can go to www.facebook.com/captain. That's CAPT.JEFF. On Twitter, I'm Jeff Nielsen, JEFFNIELSEN. And again, my website, airlinepilotguy.com. Also, just started a few weeks back a podcast with the founder and CEO of the StarQuest Production Network, SQPN. Many of you know that. And we started a podcast called The Secrets of Pan Am. Now, you remember me talking about, or somebody sent in some feedback about that many, many months back, about this new ABC show. And they started the show in September, and I think they're on episode, well, last night it was episode 7. I have not watched it yet, but I, along with Father Roderick and Marsha West, a flight attendant, talk about the show. And, you know, I'm there, I guess, for technical expertise, but it's an interesting show. It's kind of, you know, some truth to it, but if you're interested in watching the show Pan Am, or if you've been watching it and want to hear us gab about it and give our analysis, you can check it out by going to to panam.sqpn.com. That'll take you to the Secrets of Pan Am podcast. So check it out. Let me know what you think. Okay, until we meet again, wishing you blue skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds, as long as you're not landing. Take care, and God bless.
I know, but this guy doing the flying has no airline experience at all. He's a menace to himself and everything else in the air. Yes, birds too.
Okay, he's a terrible risk, but what other choice have we got?